life is in media, so this is really interesting to me. I hope that the departure is somewhat interesting to everybody that's here for media. So I'm here to talk today about the Helping Young Smokers Quit program, and specifically about one of our projects, which is looking at early abstinence among a cohort of youth in community-based programs. There's a large team of us who have worked on this project at UIC. Today, I want to first just describe what is the Helping Young Smokers Quit project, and then characterize the youth that we call treatment seekers that are in these community-based programs, and then to describe some of our analyses of the factors associated with early abstinence and other kind of intermediate outcomes that we've looked at among the youth that are in the programs, and then discuss implications for the design of cessation programs for youth. Well, what is Helping Young Smokers Quit? It was a multi-year, it actually started in 2002 with the idea that it was a five-year project, and we're now at, well, 2007, it's 5 years, but we've got some, we're still going. We're funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the National Cancer Institute, and the CDC, and our home base is at UIC, although we have collaborators across the country. Specifically Westat, which is one of the Beltway firms around here, helped us with the data collection. The overall mission of the Helping Young Smokers Quit project is to accelerate knowledge about effective interventions in youth cessation. And it's a multi-phase project. We've got a lot of things going on. Some of them have occurred sequentially over time, and some of them are happening all concurrently. So phase one was an important first step. Before we could do any of the other research 5 years ago, we had to find out what programs were out there. Before we could evaluate what worked with youth, we had really there was no idea in the field how many programs were out there in the community for youth and where they were, who they were serving. So that's what we did with phase one. We did a national survey to find programs and then to characterize them. What I'm going to talk about today is the phase two part of the program evaluation. We just got out of the field with phase three, so we went back 4 years later to the counties where we found the initial programs and investigated whether those programs are still there and if any new ones have developed. And during the course of this whole process, we've been trying to identify some of the best practices in youth cessation and create a self-evaluation toolkit for community-based programs to use. So back to phase two. The goal of the phase two part of our project is to evaluate a sample of real-world youth cessation programs. So as opposed to looking at programs that are part of a research project, we wanted to look at programs that are just there on the ground doing the best job that they can with the resources that they have. We did have some criteria for including the programs. We wanted viable programs, so they had to have an established curriculum, and they had to offer some or require some training for implementing the program among the people that did the program. So as opposed to evaluating just everything that's out there, we really wanted to look at the possible exemplars. We enrolled 41 programs across 18 states in our evaluation, which is a lot of programs, and it's an incredibly data-intensive project, but even with 41 programs, we couldn't do an evaluation of a particular program against a particular other program. So what we did was look at characteristics of programs. So we profiled what the programs do, how many sessions they offer, what the content is, what the environment in which they offer the program is like. So we looked at, for school-based programs, what the school larger school policy environment towards tobacco is, and in fact the community itself, to look at how all of these characteristics influence the cessation outcomes. And then we wanted to identify both resources and barriers to the successful program implementation. So this is our logic model, and I won't walk you all the way through it, but basically we wanted to look at factors that about the youth that were associated with positive outcomes, program factors, and then contextual factors like the organization and the community. Today I'm going to focus, well, before I get So our data collection effort for this project was just enormous. We did youth participant surveys at baseline. We had 878 youth at the end of each of the youth programs, so this was a stagger depending on when the youth were enrolled. And we had 801 that we collected at follow-up, and then we had 6-month and 12-month follow-ups as well. In addition, we interviewed 80 program leaders and asked them about the program as planned prior to doing the program and then as it was implemented. So we had a sense of what actually happened during each session. We also interviewed the organizational leaders, like the principal or the vice principal of the school, or if it was a community health organization, the administrator, as well as community leaders. So we looked for representatives from the school board, the health department, and juvenile justice, and asked them questions about how important tobacco is, kind of as a youth tobacco use and youth cessation are as issues in their community, how much support is there among the general community and among leaders in the community. The juvenile justice group, we asked about enforcement of youth anti-tobacco laws and ordinances. And then we also collected local ordinances from the local archives of each of the communities of the programs that were enrolled. So we've just got mountains of data. What I'm going to focus on today is our analyses that are just looking at the youth data, because we haven't even got to analyzing the other levels of data. So we measured 11 constructs on our youth surveys, from demographics, smoking history, attitudes about smoking, and then some motivation, efficacy, quitting history, social context, and so forth. So who are the treatment seekers? And this slide is an attempt to compare our treatment seekers with what I like to call free-range smokers from the National Youth Smoking Cessation Survey, which was a nationally representative survey of youth and young adult smokers that were not in treatment programs. So you can see that demographically our group is somewhat similar to the national sample. Our group was mostly in school. A large proportion of them had average or below average grades, and in comparison to the national sample, they seemed to be lower school performance. 68% were ever suspended or expelled from school, and I think that this reflects the fact that among some of the programs that were enrolled in our evaluation, they were mandatory programs. So in order to get into the program, kids were expelled or suspended from school for tobacco use. 28% expected to attend a four-year college, and this is a quite a bit lower percentage than in the free-range smokers. And their risky behavior was a little bit higher than the national sample. 73% lived with a smoker. 57% reported that they binge drank in the past month, and 66% were out three nights per week or more. And to me, this is an interesting portrait of the youth that are in these programs, because I think it reflects what we've observed anecdotally, is that for the youth that are enrolled in youth cessation programs in schools, they have a lot of issues in addition to smoking going on in their lives. So I think it's a really challenging group to work with and to expect strong smoking cessation outcomes. On average, they started smoking at 12 years old. 55% of them smoke daily. 78% light up within the first hour of waking, which also tells you something about their home life and that they live with smokers and or else are out of the house pretty quickly. They average smoking 6 cigarettes per day, 5 days a week. But 56% of them want to quit for good, but they have not yet quit. 20% say that they will definitely not smoke in 5 years, which I think is fairly optimistic. 74% report that they're in the smoking cessation program voluntarily, which again is pretty interesting because a lot of these programs are mandatory programs, but a lot of the youth report that they're in voluntarily. 44% have intentions to quit in the near future, and 77% intend to quit in the next 6 months. So you would kind of expect that from kids that say they're enrolled in a program where they want to quit. So, looking at factors, youth factors that are associated with successful or promising outcomes in the short term, some of our we had two major challenges. One was that we just had mountains of data, even without looking at the other levels of data that we collected, just even with the youth data. In our surveys, we had over 231 variables that measured these 11 constructs. So sorting through them and working them into our logic model and prioritizing variables that we thought would be the most important was a huge challenge. Another big challenge that we didn't really expect would be as much of a challenge as it turned out to be was that we have missing data. And that's fairly typical in longitudinal surveys. And in large surveys like we've done. And when we first looked at the missing data, we thought, oh, good, we don't have much of a problem. If any given item is less than 5% missing. So in my previous experience in data analysis, that's great, and it really presents very little problems with analysis. But when we aggregated our data, just even with the baseline to end of program, not even counting the 6 to 12-month surveys, we found that if you do what most of us do when we have a low missing data rate, which is delete the missing cases, we ended up with 43% of our observations missing because for the number of variables that we had, when you add up the 5% across all of the kids, we went from having 800 and plus observations to about 500. And that begins to be problematic because your sample no longer, the remaining students are no longer representative of the group that you originally started out with. So we had to think a lot about what to do with all of this data that we invested so much of our resources into getting. So what we did was we imputed the missing data using statistical software. We used SAS IVware. We imputed for each observation, we imputed 5 data sets so that we weren't just making up data, we were creating a distribution around each variable for each observation. And then we used the mean of the 5 imputed values to replace the missing value for each respondent. So that got us past our problem with missing data. We had a good data set that had observations for all of our respondents. But then we were still faced with the challenge of we had 231 variables that were measuring our constructs. How do we sift through them to find the most important ones that are associated with our outcomes? Because theoretically, all of them were important, or else we wouldn't have asked them on our surveys. And we certainly had some ideas, and working with our large group, I prioritized 53 variables that we selected from our theoretical framework and our logic model. And then within those 53 variables, we arrayed them by the construct, and then basically did a horse race within each of the constructs of what we felt, both bivariate and in some simple multivariate analyses, was the strongest representative of each construct. So that got us down to a manageable set of variables. But still, we were challenged by having a lot of variables, and it's very difficult to run the models and to make sense of the models with that many variables. So what we ended up doing, once we had our selected 53 variables, we did backwards selection models to find the variables that, while controlling for everything else, were significant at the 0.15 level. So we weeded out, after controlling for everything, we weeded out the remaining dogs that were in the group and came up with models that had between, 11 and 15 predictors in there. So, using baseline data, what predicted at the end of a program that youth were not smoking for at least 7 days. So amount smoked at baseline predicted whether they were able to be abstinent at 7 days at the end of the program. That's not a surprise. Whether or not they smoke by themselves was predicted. by themselves, they were much less likely to be abstinent. Now, let me explain that each row represents a variable. Each of these variables is significant at least at the 0.05 level. The ones with stars are highly significant at the 0.001 level. So amount smoked and whether or not they smoked by themselves were the strongest, but they're all predictive. What these said at the baseline about how confident they were in their ability to quit was highly predictive of whether they were able to be abstinent at the baseline. Stages of change, as we would expect, was highly predictive of later abstinence. What they thought about smoking in public places, whether it should be smoke-free or not, was predictive. Whether they lived with a smoker, whether they participated in extracurricular activities, and the attendance of the sessions. So none of this was surprising, but it took a lot of work to find what seems pretty obvious. In addition to looking at early abstinence, we also wanted to look at some intermediate outcomes and wanted to look at predictors of daily smoking. And the list of predictors for this is somewhat different than it was for abstinence. Nicotine dependency, time per cigarette, how often they smoke, and being a daily smoker at baseline were all predictive. I'm going to scroll quickly through the next few slides because I have a table that kind of summarizes all of this. We also looked at motivation at the end of the program, controlling for motivation at baseline, and also whether they were abstinent at the end of the program. Confidence as well. This table has a lot on it, but it summarizes that it shows that the things that predict abstinence are not necessarily the things that predict intermediate outcomes. And to me, that's the most important takeaway message from this slide. So the implication for designing youth cessation programs or even evaluating youth cessation programs, in my opinion, is that it's important to consider that you're looking basically at different behavioral constructs. So you're going to have different things that predict them, and it's important to not just do what I think a lot of us have done, which is look at the same predictors across different outcomes. So at this stage, one of the important conclusions that I can offer is that our results are consistent with other research on predictors of youth cessation. So we're optimistic that as we go through this evaluation, we've got some face validity, which is always nice. Commitment to the program seems important in some of the intermediate outcomes. That was consistent across all of the intermediate outcomes, and it was one of the only variables that was strong across the intermediate outcomes, was whether kids said, I plan to stick to the program. An important thing to remember here is that this is the first stage. We're dealing with multi-level models, and this is really the first level. This is just the youth level. It's going to be really interesting to incorporate information about what the program does and the context that these programs are being offered in while controlling for these individual characteristics and see what happens. And that's what we're working on right now. So, and that's it. And this is, I think with the different levels of data, our findings are going to represent one of the most comprehensive exploration of factors associated with youth quitting. So we're moving in that direction, and it's been interesting both substantively and methodologically.